So I figure we'll start off. We are in Acts chapter 22, and this is after Paul has come back to Jerusalem. So we're sitting somewhere around 58, maybe 59 BC. Everything here is a little bit loose as far as timelines. They are not hard and fast per se. You know, the farther on we get towards the 100s, it gets better because we have a lot more. We have a lot more historians. You have Pliny the Younger is born. He was a very well-known Roman historian. So you have other individuals come into play who are actually recording things. And Josephus was definitely there, but again, he was later on. And so when we start getting the records of these things, memory can be a little bit fuzzy. So we're not trying to nail everything down to the month or sometimes even the year in these cases. But this is somewhere in the 58-59 AD timeline. And so there is a lot happening in the world at this time. If you go back, in the middle of Paul's third missionary journey, Nero had taken the control of the throne as emperor of the Roman Empire. In 56-57, he had expelled the actors from Rome, and he has begun dictating reforms for circuses, for festivals, and we start to kind of get to see a little bit more about who he is historically. It's recorded all these things that he did as he's trying to kind of control people around him. Somewhere around 58 AD or so, Paul writes the book of Romans. That's around where we are now. He's imprisoned. Around 60 AD, he writes Philemon. Also, the Epistle of James is written. If you recall, James was the kind of the leader or the pastor there in the congregation in Jerusalem. And so, if you recall, actually, when he's the one who presided over the council regarding circumcision. I believe that was back in Acts 15 when they were going over that, trying to see what they were going to do regarding the Gentiles. Somewhere between 61 and 63 AD, Paul writes the books of Colossians, Ephesians, and Philippians. I mentioned Pliny the Younger. A lot happens in 62 AD, at least that we have record of. The Roman historian Pliny the Younger is born. Nero divorces his wife Octavia and marries his mistress. That's also kind of geologically at that time. A lot of people know about Pompeii, know about Mount Vesuvius. It's actually recorded in other historians' works. But the first signs of volcanic activity are there recorded. Volcanic activity from Mount Vesuvius are recorded in 62 AD. There was actually an earthquake that damaged some of the city of Pompeii. And there's records that show that it's about 18 years later, in 80 AD, that Vesuvius erupts, I believe, looking down the road. But the damages from the earthquake are not fixed. Somewhere around 62 to 63 AD, James the Just dies as one of the apostles, James the Lesser. Around 64 AD is when there is the fire in Rome, also known as the Great Fire, Great Fire of Rome, and it is believed that Nero actually started the fire because he wanted to build a bigger palace, because not long after that he starts building the Golden Palace. But what he did is he blamed it on Christians, and so they became the scapegoats, and thus starts a lot of more persecution for Christians. Okay, so we're here in Acts chapter 22. If you haven't already turned there, let's go there to Acts chapter 22. If you recall, at the tail end of Acts 21, Paul is there. He had been given advice from the leaders in Jerusalem. They say, people know you're in town, and you need to essentially watch your step. Watch what you're doing, because they're going to be watching you like a hawk. So here's our advice. Go over there, pay for the sacrifices and the cleansing of these individuals who have taken a vow. Go there with them. Show that you're not just, you know, tromping all over what are these Jewish traditions that we understand don't need to happen, but you know what? Do these and follow in this way. And so he goes into the temple complex. Some of the Jews from Asia who had come and followed him, quite tenacious individuals, zealous in their own right, but they see him, and because they see him in the complex, they're assuming that he brought with them, if you go back to chapter 21 verse 29, it says they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian with him in the city, whom they suppose that Paul had brought into the temple. So they say, oh, we think he brought him with you, with him. So a big mob starts. Paul gets beat up. They only stop because the Roman commander of the garrison comes and gets him. And Paul asks him if he can address the mob, and that was at the tail end of chapter 21. So here, Acts chapter 22, verse 21, says, "Brethren and fathers, hear my defense before you now." Actually, let me pull up this visual here as we're kind of just getting a get a comparison here. We've had this up before, but this is the this is the Temple Mount, and if you're looking at this complex, you'll see what would be at the top of the page. You see the Antonia Fortress, and that was where it says was where Herod and later the Romans commanded the garrison in order to protect the temple and to suppress religiously motivated rebellion. What occurs at the tail end of Acts 21 squarely falls into religiously motivated rebellion. Now, it might not look it, but the space between the kind of that outer wall, and we had talked about, the inner court and then the outer court, the court of the Gentiles, and then that spacing there, okay? What you have in that space between, if you look at the scale at the bottom of this graphic, it's somewhere close to 500 feet from the barracks, from the garrison over there, the Antonia Fortress, down to that outer, that wall, okay? And that wall that went into the temple complex that you then had, the court of the Gentiles, and then inside of that you had the court of the Jews, and inside of that then there was the women's court, the court of the women. And so that whole outer courtyard that was outside of that section, it's a big space. It's a huge space. And you consider how many people could have been there in the complex at the time and are filling it. It had been a mob to the point that the Romans had to come down and save Paul. And so it talks about him needing help to come up the stairs, again at the tail end of chapter 21. And so you can imagine there in this complex that they're moving him from the temple, because it would have been inside of that inner court, the court of the court of the Jews, going past that barrier wall, that short barrier wall wherein all of the warnings were, right? So you're coming out of that, going upstairs, because they're taking him. And Paul says, "Brethren and fathers, hear my defense before you now." When they heard that he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, they kept all the more silent. So to them it was a little bit surprising that he spoke in the Hebrew language. You know, the tongue of the time and the area was that of Aramaic, as we know that Jesus Christ spoke in Aramaic to a lot of the people. But Paul here chose to speak in Hebrew. And we'll see that Paul is a very astute individual when it comes to addressing his audience. How do you diffuse those tensions? And so often his words are apples of gold and settings of silver, as we read in the Proverbs. And Paul is able to turn away wrath with a soft word. And just choosing the language with which he speaks, because we know that he could speak much, a lot of languages. He could speak Greek, because that's what he spoke to the commander of the barracks. And he speaks to the individuals, and he says the same thing to them that he said initially to the commander of the barracks. He said, I am indeed a Jew, so I'm like you, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel. So even though I'm not from the area, so Cilicia would have been on the southern end of what is today Turkey. Let me actually pull up a map for that for as a reference. Let's see here. This should show that. Yes, so let's go back to this. So you can see here on this map, Cilicia is almost spot in the middle, and if you've got a large enough screen that you can kind of look in close, you'll see Tarsus, or Tarsos, as it's spelled with T-A-R-S-O-S for us English people. English speaking is T-A-R-S-U-S, but it's right there under the second sea of Cilicia, and that was a very central component to the Roman Empire, but as you can see, it's quite a bit farther north. Only at the bottom of your map do you see Damascus, if you look down towards where Israel was. And Damascus is on the far northeast corner of the region of Judea. And so, if you'll note, the time of this map is 98 to 117 AD. The Roman regions were constantly morphing. But so this is one where it shows you, at least where Tarsus was, in regards to the Roman Empire. I'll go back to the Temple Mount here. Actually, here we can look at this one here again as well. This will show a little bit more. This is just the region itself, and the Roman Empire going all the way down into Egypt. And then this here is a little bit more detailed map of the Roman Empire, and you can see again where Judea is in comparison to where Tarsus is, and the various garrisons that were around the area at the empire at the time. But so Paul references where he's from. He acknowledges that he's not from the area, but he does say that there's a similarity. There's a similarity between he and his audience. In fact, he was raised, brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel. So he's born in Tarsus, but brought up at the feet of Gamaliel. And that doesn't mean that he was a child there necessarily, learning from Gamaliel. But to be brought up at the feet of means that he was a disciple of Gamaliel. We know from other passages in Gamaliel that he was a Pharisee, and that he was a very respected Pharisee. And the sect of a Pharisee, in many ways, the Sadducees were more of a socio-political grouping of people. To be a Pharisee would be more considered what we would call, if we were to make distinctions, you have Orthodox Jews and you have Reformed Jews. We have within our belief system, you might say somebody is more conservative or, you know, maybe they're more liberal about things. The Pharisees prided themselves on being able to look into the law and to make sure that they were trying to follow it to a T. So they were very, very specific. So he's brought up in that mindset, trained by the preeminent Pharisee of the time in Gamaliel, taught according to the strictness of our father's law. And that father's law that he's referring to is the law of Moses. And so he's harkening back and just drawing these connections, seeking to draw these connections with his audience, and was zealous toward God as you all are today. I think this is such a wonderful example of how to hopefully diffuse a crowd. If you go back, keep your finger here, but you go back to Acts chapter 17, another popular introduction for Paul and speaking to a potentially hostile crowd there. This one's over in Athens. Acts chapter 17, verse 22. Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For as I was passing through, I considered and considered the objects of your worship. I even found an altar with this inscription to the unknown God. Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you. That's a pretty amazing segue. I notice you're a bunch of pagans and you have all of these gods. You know, let me tell you about a new one, one that you didn't quite know about. No, that's not what he said. He has, I mean, in those couple sentences, he is able to, actually that's a Pauline sentence, so it's all one. Actually, it's quoted as two. So he's got this, and he shares their commonality, and he starts to build from that. In the same way here in Acts chapter 22, Paul is starting from the commonality. I'm speaking to you in Hebrew. I was trained by somebody you know and respect, taught according to the thing that we all believe and that we all know and that we all honor there in the law of our father. The strictness of our father's law was zealous towards God, as you all are today. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and delivering into prisons both men and women. As also the high priest bears me witness, and all the council of the elders, from whom I also received letters to the brethren, and went to Damascus to bring in chains even those who were there to Jerusalem to be punished. Here we see Paul really starting to build his defense. He is addressing the mob. This is not actually a court of law or a trial. This is nothing more than what one would say the court of public opinion, because he's speaking to the mob, right? But what Paul is doing here is he's ascertaining his history, a record of his conduct, and individuals who can corroborate that. You know, it's been 25 years now, so it was about 33 AD, 34 AD or so when Paul was there at the death of Stephen, a martyr, right? And we'll actually go to that a little bit later. But it's been about 25 years, because we're now around 58, 59 AD. And so what Paul is saying is, here's the history. Just in case you didn't know, yeah, remember Gamaliel? I learned from him. Remember this way? I persecuted, asked the high priest, he can bear witness, also the council of elders, because I went to them asking for letters in order to be able to go as far as Damascus. And as I mentioned, Damascus from Jerusalem, you're looking at about 200 miles, and it was up in the far east, the northeast region of Judea. And so he's going to the farthest extent of the region to persecute people. And he's like, I did this zealously, much like you guys are zealous today. Acts chapter 7, let's again hold your spot here. Acts chapter 7, verse 58. We'll see here, just to keep this as background here. Acts chapter 7, verse 58. This is Stephen was martyred. They cast Stephen out of the city, stoned him, and the witnesses laid down their clothes at the feet of a young man named Saul. They stoned Stephen as he was calling on God and saying, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. Then he knelt down and cried out with a loud voice, Lord, do not charge him with his sin. And when he had said this, he fell asleep. Now Saul was consenting to his death. And at that time a great persecution arose against the church which was at Jerusalem, and they were all scattered throughout the region of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. And devout men carried Stephen to his burial and made great lamentation over him. As for Saul, he made havoc of the church, entering every house and dragging off men and women, committing them to prisons. Therefore those who were scattered went everywhere preaching the word. But we see here what Saul did. Made havoc of the church, entering every house and dragging off men and women, committing them to prison. This is exactly what he admits to here in chapter 22. He says, you know, bringing those to chains, even those who were there as far as Damascus to Jerusalem to be punished. Another spot is Acts chapter 9. Acts chapter 9, verse 1. Just a good reference to have as we're tying all of these stories together, these accounts. Shouldn't call them stories, should call them accounts, because these are first-hand, second-hand historical accounts of what has happened to those who walked before us in the way. Acts chapter 9, verse 1, then Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked letters from him to the synagogues of Damascus, so that if he found anyone who were of the way, whether men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. So, Paul accounts this again to the crowd, saying, you know, I was very zealous. I understand the energy that you have, the desire that you have, the zeal that you have for your way of life. Also, you know, I was there. Ask these people. And then Paul goes and he says, now it happened as I journeyed and came near Damascus at about noon, suddenly a great light from heaven shone around me. And we move from something that all of the individuals who were angry in the mob and the crowd at that time, we move from a story that they would go and ask their people to corroborate into the story of Paul's conversion. And it's interesting because this is actually the second time in Scripture. There's a third time again in Acts chapter 26, but you've got it in Acts chapter 9, Acts 22, and again in Acts 26. We have three accounts, records, of Paul's conversion. This again being the second one. But these are accounts that Paul is sharing here with the crowd in Jerusalem after he has already said, we have common ground. We know the same people. You can go and ask them about how I conducted myself. And so he's building that basis. And not always, but oftentimes, if you can build a basis of similarity, of commonality, you know, you respect this individual, this researcher, this sports figure, this minister, this person, whoever it is, and they will vouch for me. They will, or maybe not vouch, but they will say, yeah, that's exactly what happened. What they're saying is true. Even if you don't like them, but what they're saying is true, then it can be harder to dispel what they say or what they bring forward later on. And that's kind of what Paul's doing here, because now he's bringing into account his conversion, which is a transition from the way, the law of their fathers, right? The specificity of that, of following Judaism, to following the way and following Christ. But he says, it happened as I journeyed and came near Damascus at about noon. Suddenly a great light from heaven shone around me, and I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? So I answered, who are you, Lord? And he said to me, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting. And those who were with me indeed saw the light and were afraid, but they did not hear the voice of him who spoke to me. So I said, what shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, arise and go into Damascus, and there you will be told all things which are appointed to you for you to do. And since I could not see for the glory of that light, being led by the hand of those who were with me, I came into Damascus. Keep your hand here in Acts chapter 22. Let's go back to Acts chapter 9 again. We read the first two verses. Paul, still breathing threats, goes to Damascus. Verse 3, as he journeyed, he came near Damascus, and suddenly a light shone around him from heaven. Same thing he shared in Acts chapter 22. And he fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to him, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And he said, Saul said at that time, who are you, Lord? And the Lord said, I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. Is it hard for you to kick against the goads? So he, trembling and astonished, said, Lord, what do you want me to do? Then the Lord said to him, arise and go into the city, and you will be told what you must do. And the men who journeyed with him stood speechless, hearing a voice, but seeing no one. And then Saul arose from the ground, and when his eyes were open, he saw no one. But they led him by the hand and brought him into Damascus. And he was there 3 days without sight, and neither ate nor drank. So we have essentially a carbon copy. There are a few differences there. He says in verse 9 of chapter 22 that those who were with me indeed saw the light and were afraid, but they did not hear the voice of him who spoke to me. So they saw a light, they didn't hear the voice. But it says in chapter 9, that they hearing a voice but seeing no one. So you can hear a voice and you cannot quite understand what it is. You can hear a voice and not know what is being said. So we do know actually from these accounts that it was Paul who understood what was being said, not the companions who were with him, because the message was for him and not for them. Also, again, as I had mentioned, this is the second time that Paul's account of his conversion is being shared. We'll get into the third one in Acts chapter 26. But just as a point of reference, Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 6, Deuteronomy 19, verse 15, as well as Matthew 18, verse 16. And Matthew 18, verse 16 is referring back to Deuteronomy 17, verse 6. But just talk about that it is by the mouth of two or three witnesses that a story should be corroborated. So we have recorded in Scripture the story of Paul three times, his conversion, just as in much the same way that we have four for the life and the teachings of Jesus Christ. And so we have things corroborated that bring validity to it. In addition to that, in his sharing of this story, Paul is talking about the individuals who were with him. So people who were alive at the time, in Jerusalem at the time, would have known, that's when Paul went absolutely nuts, because he used to be on our side, and then all of a sudden he switched, he's blind, and now he's starting to teach this other stuff. The people who brought him or were with him as companions on the way to Damascus would have been able to be there. It wasn't just one, because you're using the plural. So at least two people were with Paul, so they could have corroborated the story of what happened about hearing the voice or hearing someone talking but not knowing what was being said. They could have corroborated his blindness, having to lead him into Damascus. This guy is not lying. This is what happened. And again, it goes and it starts to bring some more validity to what Paul is trying to share with them. Verse 12 of Acts chapter 22. Paul again here is, he shares something about Ananias that we don't have in the first account in Acts chapter 9. He talks about Ananias, but Paul here describes Ananias in Acts chapter 22 in a way that we don't see in Acts chapter 9. He says, verse 12, "And then a certain Ananias, a devout man according to the law, having a good testimony with all the Jews who dwelt there, came to me, and he stood and said to me, 'Brother Saul, receive your sight.' And at that same hour I looked up at him." So if you go back to Acts chapter 9, we see here that the description of Ananias in Acts chapter 9 verse 10 is that there was a certain disciple at Damascus named Ananias, and to him the Lord said in a vision, "Ananias," and he tells him what to do. But that's the description. We see that he is a disciple at Damascus. Okay? And that's what we get for Ananias. But to be a disciple and a disciple of Jesus Christ, and to have a good testimony with all the Jews who dwelt there. So it's again corroborating the story. Also, here's an individual who has a good reputation that you can go and ask. It's not like the people over there in Damascus don't know who he is. They know who he is. He had a good reputation. And he's the one who anointed Saul. Verse 14, "Then he said, 'The God of our fathers has chosen you that you should know his will and see the just one and hear the voice of his mouth. For you will be his witness to all men of what you have seen and heard. And now why are you waiting? Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord.'" We get packed into those couple verses a lot of information, because we see here what Ananias tells Saul or Paul. He says, "The God of our fathers has chosen you that you should know his will and see the just one and hear the voice of his mouth." And so this kind of goes part and parcel with Paul in other areas, saying that he was taught directly by Jesus Christ. He got to hear his word and learn from him, much in the same way that the apostles did for those 40 days between the Passover and the day of Pentecost. They had him with them for 40 days after his resurrection. I guess technically not there from the Passover, but from the wave sheaf there, as it was offered until Pentecost. But Paul says here in Acts chapter 22, verse 17, "Now it happened when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple that I was in a trance and saw him saying to me," speaking of Jesus Christ, "saying, 'Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, for they will not receive your testimony concerning me.' So I said, 'Lord, they know that in every synagogue I imprison and beat those who believed on you. And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I also was standing by consenting to his death and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him.' And then he said to me, depart, for I will send you far away, far from here, to the Gentiles. Again, much, just keeping in line with what Paul has done in trying to find a way to connect to the audience. If you have just persecuted people and they know that, how likely are they to just love whatever message you're going to share with them? It's highly unlikely. And so we see Paul being sent away to go to the Gentiles. Also in this, we have, in much the same way as Paul is building up his defense, right? He's essentially saying, you know these people, you trust these people have a good reputation, and if you're going to throw accusations at me, then what does that say of your trust in the judgment of these other individuals for what they were willing to do, or what they were willing to entrust to me? And so, again, oftentimes you have to pick and choose, and people can do this, and you'll get cognitive dissonance, you'll get this kind of, it doesn't compute, it doesn't match up if I believe this person and I trust this person, but they trust this person who I don't want to trust. Is kind of where Paul is going with all this as he's sharing the history. Also, let's go back to, again, one more time to Acts chapter 9. In verse 23 here, we see Paul's reference there from verse 18, where Christ tells him, make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, for they will not receive your testimony concerning me. In Acts chapter 9, verse 23, it says, now after many days were passed, the Jews plotted to kill him. See, because he came back to Jerusalem, and he's teaching, he's preaching the way. They're like, what happened? We just lost, we lost our pit bull. We lost our guy who was going to go after them. But their plot became known to Saul, and they watched the gates day and night to kill him. And we'll see another instance in which Paul is a plot to kill him is made known to Paul. But here we understand that that plot was made known to him because Jesus Christ told him. We learn that in chapter 22, verse 18, that Christ told him, saying, make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, for they will not receive your testimony concerning me. They're going to kill you. Verse 25. So then the disciples took him by night and led him down through the wall in a large basket. Okay? So Paul says, again, sharing all of this. And then he says, verse 21, verse 20, and when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I also was standing by consenting to his death and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him. And then he said to me, depart, for I will send you far from here to the Gentiles. So his conversation with Christ. And when Paul says, depart, when he's conveying what Christ said to him, Paul says, depart, for I will send you far away from here to the Gentiles. Verse 22, and they, this is the mob, listened to him until this word, and then they raised their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, for he is not fit to live. He needs to die. This guy is wrong. Because at the very heart of everything that was being thrown at Paul as an accusation, it was dealing with the Gentiles. The root of the issue at hand is that Paul had gone to the Gentiles. He's gone to this way that is inviting in the Gentiles and inviting in these other people who don't know the law and the specificity of our fathers, who aren't, you know, in the same way. They don't have the history with this understanding that we do, that the Jews do, that the Pharisees do, that we do. He had gone to the Gentiles. He's accused of bringing a Gentile into the temple. He was the concern, if you go back to Acts chapter 21, verse 21, the concern there that was shared with Paul, he says, they have been informed, these are the Jews, have been informed about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children nor to walk according to the customs. You know, they're saying you're teaching the Jews and the Gentiles alike that they don't need the laws and the customs of Moses. When in actuality, you can go back and say, no, we didn't say that to all the Jews, all the believers. We said that to the people who are first just now coming into the faith, that this is not something you have to follow. But we never told the people who knew and who understand that they don't have to do that. So the accusations that are being leveled against Paul are all in regards to his interaction with the Gentiles. So then they're saying he's not fit to live. In verse 23, there's, they cried out and tore off their clothes and threw dust in the air. It is supposed that this is kind of their way, because they're in the mob. The Roman commander of the barracks, the garrison there, has Paul in custody. He's in the hands, Paul is in his hands, not in the hands of the mob, because you remember they pulled him away and they had to help him up the steps. But it's kind of like them, as they're throwing the dirt in the air, it's as much as they could do at that moment, where he needs to be stoned. This is not right. What he's saying is, you know, is heresy. Why would you go to the Gentiles? Verse 24. The commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks and said that he should be examined under scourging, so that he might know why they shouted so against him. You know, first he says, are you the Egyptian who caused that uproar in the wilderness? You know, is that you? And that's what he asked him at the tail end of, that's in 21 verse 38, chapter 21 verse 38, right, with the 4,000 assassins. And now he's like, who is this guy that he can create such an uproar? Right, we have to find out. So they're going to examine him under scourging. Most people did not survive a Roman scourging. It was very often scourging to death. There were the accusations. Many people would admit to the accusations, but they would not survive the scourging. It's kind of like the Inquisition. If you decry decry anybody but anyone but the Catholic faith and the Pope, well, then we'll let you live. But then you go ahead and you admit to it, and it doesn't really matter, because just the brutality that people often faced. So as they bound him with thongs, the leather straps, Paul said to the centurion who stood by. Now he doesn't say it to the commander of the garrison. He says it to the centurion who stood by. He just says, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? And when the centurion heard that, he went and told the commander, saying, take care what you do, for this man is a Roman. Then the commander came and said to him, tell me, are you a Roman? And he said, yes. The commander answered, with a large sum I obtained the citizenship. And Paul said, but I was born a citizen. Then immediately those who were about to examine him, also known as scourge him, withdrew from him, and the commander was also afraid after he found out that he was a Roman, and because he had bound him. So there were rights and liberties of Roman citizens. We'll kind of unpack this from the beginning. First of all, in verse 25, it is very telling. A lot of people can say, well, know your rights, and yes, know your rights, but there is a lot that Paul was willing to endure. You can see back in Acts chapter 16, verse 37. Let's turn back there for reference. Acts chapter 16, verse 37. Paul was already beaten. This is in Philippi, right? He ends up preaching and singing hymns. The Philippian jailer and his family are converted. Right, but in verse 37, the keeper of the prison reported to Paul again that the magistrate said, "Go and let him go." And Paul said, "Now therefore depart in peace." And Paul said to them, "They have beaten us openly, uncondemned Romans." And the uncondemned Romans that he's referring to are him and Titus, right? They have beaten us openly, uncondemned Romans, and have thrown us into prison. And now, do they put us out secretly? No, indeed. Let them come themselves and let us out. You see, because there were those expectations, there were those rights and privileges of Roman citizenship that we'll get to in a little bit. But Paul did not take his rights and rub everybody else's nose in it. Paul, again, like he was very judicious in selecting the words that he used in speaking to a crowd, was also very aware of when to assert his rights. You know, there's one thing to be scourged at a Roman, in the Roman barracks, right? Judea was known for uprising, and to have something like that to where they needed to be tamped down was a big thing. Rome did not like having areas where there were large issues or known hotspots and things like that. If you actually go, if you go back to this picture of the Roman Empire, you'll see, if you look, everywhere there is a yellow square, there is a legionary base. There is one, there are actually there is one down in Judea. I won't butcher the name down there, but it's just north of Judea. It's number 27. But that was a Roman legionary base right there in Judea. If you were to go up and look at Philippi, right, up in Thrace, there's not a Roman legionary. It's just a city or a town. And so what you're going to get there, where you're not in the Roman barracks, is a very different kind of welcome, shall we say. Okay, so Paul's there in Jerusalem, and he just very discreetly says to the centurion, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who's a Roman and uncondemned? There's a lot of discussion about how Paul became a Roman citizen, and it's actually a point of interest here by the commander. At that time, it was almost, you could have a waxed scroll, or you could have proof, essentially an ID card, to show that you were a Roman citizen. But if you were to claim Roman citizenship and be found not to be a Roman citizen, the penalty was death. So people didn't just go off lightly stating that they were a Roman citizen. So oftentimes, it was taken at face value. If you say you're a Roman citizen, I'm going to believe that you're a Roman citizen, because I recognize the fallout of what would happen if that is not the case. In addition to that, there are various theories as to how Paul became a Roman citizen. There's one that says his parents were freed slaves. They had been enslaved, captured, taken north out of Judea, right, during the conquest of Pompeii. So they were up there then, in Cilicia, in Tarsus, and then they were set free by their master. Once they were freed, then any of their offspring were free Roman citizens. There's that theory. There's also the theory that as Cilicia was conquered, and then when it was transferred fully into, when it became a full-fledged part of the Roman Empire, as opposed to kind of like a vassal region, in that regard, that there was a freeing starting somewhere around, I think it was 40 to 45 BC, they started giving people Roman citizenship. And so there's the idea that maybe in that that area he was given citizenship. But again, there isn't hard and fast proof about that. There's also the theory that Paul's parents did some great sort of feat in helping somebody, either militaristic or in some other way, to earn their citizenship, because it could be granted in that way. Again, none of them can be concretely confirmed. They are theories. But what we do know is that Paul's parents had to be citizens for him to be born a citizen. So it's not something that he purchased. It is something that was bequeathed to him just by the nature of his parents being citizens. Okay, and so, and with that being the case, that's something that, again, as the centurion said, you could buy it, but to have it and not have had to buy it, and to at least be a second generation Roman citizen, was not a light thing. So, just as history going back, this is why some of these theories can't be corroborated. Cilicia was annexed to the Roman Republic in 64 BC. And so in order for Paul's parents, that would have had to be probably closer to his grandparents when it was annexed and sent over as a part of the Roman Republic. In 67 BC, Tarsus was absorbed into the province of Cilicia. 3 years later, Cilicia was annexed into the Roman Republic. And so, again, there's a possibility that there is water to that theory. Tarsus was actually one of the leading cities. Paul said no. He said born in Tarsus of Cilicia. It was no small city, as he said to commander of the barracks in chapter 21, verse 39. Tarsus was one of the leading cities in the Eastern Empire. It had an economy based on agriculture and the linen industry. If you recall, Paul was also a tent maker. But it had a flourishing school of Greek philosophy. And it also had a commanding position at the southern end of the Cilician Gates, which were the only major pass in the Tarsus Mountains. And so it was a very good military location. When it comes to Roman citizens, there are some rights and some freedoms that they have. So kind of just share this. This is from Wikipedia. You can go and Google it yourself, but there are some of these that are quite interesting. There was the right to vote in Roman assemblies, the right to stand for civil or public office, the right to make legal contracts and to hold property as a Roman citizen. There was legal recognition that was developed in the 3rd century BC of the growing international scope of Roman affairs and the need for Roman law to deal with situations between Roman citizens and foreign persons. So this is, you're talking about international, essentially international law. So the Roman legal codification became accepted as international law. So it wasn't just somebody else's laws or pick who was. Roman law became international law. And it was based on the highly developed commercial law of the Greek city-states and of other maritime powers. There was also the right to have a lawful marriage with a Roman citizen according to Roman principles, to have the legal rights over the family and for the children of any such marriage to be counted as Roman citizens. And so this is kind of where it pertains to Paul. There was also the right to preserve one's level of citizenship upon relocation, so moving from one area to the other. Just because you went from one province to another didn't mean you were no longer the same level of citizen, because they did have, it was cast in that way, where they, you could be a citizen, but there were different hierarchies within that. So you had the right to preserve your citizenship upon relocation, to be able to have a comparable status. This worked then there was also the right of immunity, the right of immunity from some taxes and other legal obligations, especially local rules and regulations. So if there were local things in any of the other colonies, you may not have to specifically follow those, so you might have a right to immunity from that. You have the right to sue in courts, and the right to be sued, the right to have a legal trial, to appear before a proper court and to defend oneself, and that's kind of what Paul is starting to do here. You have the right to appeal from the decisions of magistrates and to appeal the lower court decisions, which we will see Paul kind of do later on. Following the early 2nd century BC Porcian laws, a Roman citizen could not be tortured or whipped and could commute sentences of death to voluntary exile. So instead of being killed, you could have voluntary exile unless he was found guilty of treason. If accused of treason, a Roman citizen had the right to be tried in Rome, and even if sentenced to death, no Roman citizen could be sentenced to die on the cross, which is interesting because tradition has Paul not dying on a cross. We do know that Peter was crucified, but he was not a Roman citizen. But Paul traditionally is understood, believed to have been beheaded by Nero in Rome. And so this, the second to the last one that I read, a Roman citizen could not be tortured or whipped and could commute sentences of death to voluntary exile. So not only had he been bound without a proper court and the opportunity to defend himself, but he had also, they were getting ready to torture him, to whip him, just to find out, you know, what is it about this guy that that is so special. And so that takes us to the end, where the leader of the barracks in verse 29 of chapter 22, then immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him, and the commander was also afraid after he found out that he was a Roman and because he had bound him. And so, as a result of finding out that Paul is a Roman, And he says, the next day, because he wanted to know for certain, because he couldn't figure out himself through scourging and whipping, right? He wanted to know for certain why he was accused by the Jews. He released Paul from his bonds and commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear and brought Paul down and set him before him. So the next day, so he stays with them that night in the barracks. And the next day, they have the whole council, the chief priests, all the council to appear. And he brings Paul before them so he can get to the bottom of it. Again, because he can't get to the bottom of it via a scourging or anything like that. There's quite a bit here in chapter 23, and we only have a few minutes left. So I don't necessarily want to start tackling all of that. We should be able to finish that the next time, but I ended up spending a bit more time talking about the Paul and being a citizen, but I found that interesting when I was going through it, just to kind of see what was there, some of the history for what Roman citizens could do, how one went about getting it. Are there any questions or thoughts that you have? If you wanted to text me or shoot me an email, I'll check my email real quick if you have anything in line with that. But I just realized, now that I've finished, that I forgot to dial in for all of those who are on the phone hookup. I knew I was missing something. Okay. Well, I don't see anything coming through, but I don't want to start tackling in here into the argument that Paul has with the I won't say the argument, but the presentation to the Sanhedrin. There's a lot more to unpack with that, just in regards to the type of the type of happenings that were around with that. There's some records of how those sorts of cases and laws went on. I guess not cases and laws, cases and hearings went on, but I think that we'll finish it there. We'll actually end it off early this evening. If you do have thoughts or questions that I either don't catch tonight or that you think of after this, feel free to stop me at services. We can talk about that, any of those interesting points then. But with that, I hope you have a great rest of your evening, a great Sabbath, and I look forward to seeing everyone who's able to make it to Morton tomorrow to see you then.